Welcome to The Character Cure. I'm Dr. Paul Miller. Self-Mastery, Part 1. A couple of years ago, I finally relented and let my kids get a puppy. Our family dog is now almost 80 pounds and still trying my patience inside the house. But at least he's given me greater insight into Aristotle's frequent dog references. In Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle compares people whose actions are driven by anger to a dog who barks violently at the door before he finds out whether the visitor is a friend. As a new dog owner, I know exactly what he's talking about. Interestingly, Aristotle's point with this dog reference is that people who are driven by anger to do improper things are not quite as bad as people who are driven solely by the desire for pleasure. While uncontrolled anger can become dangerous, Aristotle observes that there's a certain logic behind the original impulse. You get angry for a reason, however misguided or impaired that reasoning might be. Our virtue for today is what I call self-mastery. Aristotle called it sophrosyne, which is usually translated into English as temperance or self-control. It implies a soundness of mind, a mastery of the emotions, and a mature understanding of your personal limits and capacities. Along with practical wisdom, justice, and courage, self-mastery is one of the four cardinal virtues, one of the four character cornerstones for a happy life. I'd like to start by considering some extreme forms of self-denial as a possible path to self-mastery. To pursue spiritual enlightenment or moral perfection, monks, nuns, yogis, and hermits have long embraced what we call ascetic practices. These practices include sleeping on nails, sitting for hours in the freezing snow, living for years on a platform on top of a pillar, patiently enduring insect bites without harming the insect, fasting for long periods of time, and meditating while holding the body in a painful posture. Asceticism proves what human beings are capable of achieving on the path to self-mastery. Of course, the ascetic lifestyle is easy to criticize and denounce. We typically perceive monks and hermits as misguided and excessive, in rejecting worldly pleasure and treating the body as inherently evil. We also tend to be wary of people who are preoccupied with salvation in another life, especially if it means disengaging from the present one. But before we utterly reject any and all forms of asceticism, I'd like to pause for a moment and ask whether moderate forms of asceticism might not only be appropriate, but essential in cultivating true self-mastery. In ancient Greece, most philosophers understood that the quest for wisdom could not be achieved without self-mastery. These philosophers, especially the Stoics and the Cynics, would generally wear simple clothes and live an extremely frugal lifestyle. They knew that worldly pleasure and the desire for power could easily distract them from the path of knowledge and wisdom. So, while I'm not aware of any evidence that Aristotle and Plato engaged in severe ascetic practices, it's clear that they were fully committed to taming and controlling excessive passions and appetites. It's interesting that our English word asceticism is derived from the Greek word ascesis, which originally meant training or exercise, specifically athletic training. If we bring both the ancient and modern meanings together, we might suggest that just as an athlete needs to train his or her mind and body to reach the highest level of competition, we need to train our minds and bodies to acquire cardinal virtues such as practical wisdom and self-mastery. Moderate forms of asceticism might include fasting for 24 hours, waking up early in the morning to meditate, strictly limiting technology and media consumption for an entire week, and locking up credit cards. In my particular case, an ascetic practice might even include training and taking care of a labradoodle puppy. We'll come back to asceticism later. But now I'd like to explain more about why I prefer the term self-mastery for this cardinal virtue. Let's talk for a minute about some possible misconceptions regarding self-control. When we think of someone who possesses a remarkable amount of self-control, we typically see them as having tremendous willpower to resist temptation. When it comes to their desires, we believe these people are just like us. The difference is they simply control their natural human impulses, such as anger, sexual drive, food cravings, and the desire for sleep. But what if some people are hardly even tempted by the lure of intemperate pleasure? Perhaps their self-control has little to do with willpower. So how does Aristotle weigh in on this question? He says it depends, that some people really do just have tremendous willpower, the capacity for supreme self-denial. He calls this virtue enkrateia. These self-controlled people listen to the dictates of reason, even though they may experience an almost irresistible passion for pleasure. They simply possess the moral strength to resist temptation. But Aristotle is convinced that the ideal form of self-control resides on a higher plane. He uses a different term, sophrosyne, to describe people who make good choices with greater ease and spontaneity. They're hardly even tempted to overindulge in pleasure. These people have achieved a greater level of self-mastery. To borrow a phrase from Henry David Thoreau, they've learned to live with the license of a higher order of beings. Now let's take a step back and ask a couple of questions. First, is the state of self-mastery described by Aristotle even worth striving for? Does it require the sort of extreme self-sacrifice typical of monks in a monastery? Does it mean becoming less passionate about life, essentially losing your desire for pleasure? I personally know a man who has deliberately chosen to take a cold shower every day for the past 30 or 40 years. His habit started because he wanted to save money on his heating and electricity bill, but now it's more just a matter of what he's always done. Is this self-mastery, or is self-mastery something else altogether? Perhaps it's better defined as a refined capacity to enjoy the wholesome pleasures of life. Let's start with Aristotle's views on this question. Is self-mastery simply a synonym for the ascetic lifestyle of those who deny all worldly pleasure? Aristotle would say absolutely not. Self-mastery is about thoroughly enjoying the right pleasures in the right amount at the right time. It's a personality that's built on disciplined mental and physical habits, but it comes with a sort of practical wisdom that delights in particular well-suited pleasures. One of Aristotle's simplest and most profound ideas is that good habits produce an inherent pleasure. Human nature loves to fall into routine, whether for good or for bad. In cultivating virtue, one of the beautiful things is that habits allow you to experience pleasure in activities you might not have imagined to be pleasurable, like waking up early in the morning and welcoming the dawn. You also derive great pleasure from working hard to accomplish something meaningful. You expand your knowledge, provide service to others, and make the world a better place. Self-mastery includes an appreciation for bodily pleasures as well, in the right amount, at the right time, in the right place. We're talking about people who don't have time for extreme self-indulgence, but they appreciate a good meal as much as anyone, and they delight in the sexual intimacy that comes with a committed relationship. Self-mastery even has room for certain overpowering passions, when those passions drive them in a positive direction. Ambition, loyalty, and love provide an animating force that calls upon the best that's within us. A passionate thirst for knowledge, for example, can lead to a satisfying, pleasurable journey towards self-improvement and service. Because self-mastery is accompanied by practical wisdom, it embraces a form of self-denial. Not self-denial for its own sake, but as a means to achieving proper ends. Self-mastery is not narcissistic or sociopathic, practicing self-restraint in a way that exploits other people in getting what it wants. On the contrary, with self-mastery, you strengthen your family relationships and friendships, respond to the call to serve your community, and inspire others to follow the same path. Here again, we're not talking about people who may have achieved, either naturally or through strenuous effort, a stoic rejection of all desire. We're not talking about unfeeling robots who've lost their humanity. We're talking about an abundant life full of vibrant relationships, hopeful energy, and profound pleasure. That should settle the question about whether self-mastery is a desirable state of character, at least according to Aristotle's lofty ideals. Now let's turn to a second question. How can a person who struggles mightily to resist his desire for selfish pleasure mature into a state of true self-mastery? The answer to this question doesn't seem quite as clear in Aristotle's philosophy. Here's why. Aristotle groups the vast majority of people into one of four personalities, and he doesn't really explore the possibility of changing or progressing from one category to another. Let's look briefly at each of these four types. The first is the self-indulgent person. This type of person engages in excessive pleasure without feeling any regret. He sees the selfish and sociopathic pursuit of pleasure as the main purpose of life. Because his actions are not checked by a sense of remorse or by the dictates of reason, Aristotle would say he's almost incurable. The next personality type is the morally weak person. She has a conscience, knows that she should avoid overindulgence, but doesn't have the willpower to resist. She embraces intemperate pleasure and then feels a sense of guilt and powerlessness. She wants to do better, but for whatever reason lacks the confidence and willpower. The next personality type is the morally strong person, the enkratis. Like the morally weak person, he possesses an intense desire for inappropriate forms of pleasure, but he listens to the dictates of reason and somehow gathers enough willpower to maintain a firmness of character. By most outward appearances, he's a rock, the epitome of virtue. The last personality type is, of course, self-mastery, which we've spent most of our time talking about. She is the sophron, or the person who has achieved the characteristic of sophrosyne. In many ways, she appears no different from the morally strong person, but her life seems less of a struggle, her actions more effortless and natural. Her thoroughly reasonable nature embraces the right pleasures at the right time and in the right way, because this is what she wants. Her desires are fully aligned with practical wisdom. Now, to be clear, these personality types should not necessarily be seen as a natural progression in moral development, from unchecked overindulgence, to indulgence accompanied by regret, to moral strength, and finally to true self-mastery. Aristotle, at least, doesn't seem to see it that way. Now, in reality, nobody fits precisely into one of these personality types. You might even see all four tendencies in different aspects of your personal life. But if someone possesses a genuine desire to change and the humility to accept help from friends and family, only the most pessimistic view of human nature would speak against the possibility of change, the possibility of progressing more fully towards self-mastery. While dramatic change is not typical, anything is possible if we're willing to cultivate certain habits. This is the purpose of character education. I believe Aristotle would be particularly open to progressing from the third personality type, moral strength, to self-mastery. He would also note that moral strength, the third type, is vastly superior to both self-indulgence, the first type, and moral weakness, the second type, because people with moral strength listen to reason. So how can you transform your moral strength or even your moral weakness into self-mastery? One way of viewing the change is a sort of spiritual conversion, where you experience a change of heart. You acquire a new worldview, a more profound way of anticipating and experiencing pleasure. You're converted, body and soul, embracing a higher degree of knowledge that leads to virtue. This is the kind of knowledge that Socrates speaks of when he says that knowledge is virtue, and that someone who possesses knowledge is no longer capable of anything but excellence. What does it mean to achieve this new state of perceiving pleasure? As we've discussed, through developing different mental and physical habits, you learn to find pleasure in things of greater value. The way to rise above intemperate pleasure is not necessarily to wage a lifelong war against your passions. If you really desire greater virtue and self-mastery, at some point you have to experience a change of heart, where you discover a capacity for profound pleasure in other things. This change of heart is then sustained by practical wisdom and self-knowledge, keeping you from compromising situations where you're likely to succumb to old weakness. When you've achieved self-mastery, you know your limits and you act accordingly. So there you have it. We've done our best to understand the path that leads to self-mastery. As with practical wisdom, self-mastery is a high ideal. It comes with a sort of lofty discourse typical of Aristotle's moral philosophy. Now let's return to our question about asceticism. We've mentioned that Aristotle's self-mastery does not seem to describe the ascetic lifestyle. But could it still be true that one of the keys to developing self-mastery is to embrace ascetic practices as a form of training or exercise? We'll take up this question again in our next segment as we explore some informative social scientific studies on self-control. Welcome back to The Character Cure. Self-Mastery, Part 2. To begin this segment, let's talk about two scientists who offer a glimpse of what self-mastery can look like. You've probably heard of the Polish-born, Nobel Prize-winning chemist Marie Curie. She was the first woman to be awarded the Nobel Prize and the only person ever to receive the award in two different sciences. In 1903, she shared the Nobel Prize in Physics with her husband Pierre for their radiation research. A few years later, after Pierre was tragically killed in an accident, she received a Nobel in Chemistry for her own work in measuring radioactivity. In a recent biography of Marie Curie and her daughters, Shelley Emling observes that what motivated Marie was the sheer pleasure of the beauty of science and the enormous satisfaction derived from making the previously unknowable known. By all accounts, she desired neither public recognition nor wealth, strongly preferring to expend her energies on productive scientific research. Albert Einstein is quoted as saying that Curie was of all celebrated beings the only one whom fame has not corrupted. When she was in her 20s, she received a scholarship that she eventually returned when she no longer needed the money. She gave away much of her Nobel Prize money to other people. She frequently turned down awards, and to benefit the scientific community, she refused to patent some of her most important work. Marie Curie derived her greatest pleasure from serving humanity through scientific research. She rejected wealth and fame, believing that such things were hollow, unstable, and fleeting. Curie encountered significant obstacles in her quest for scientific knowledge. She was slandered in the press and viewed with suspicion as a rare woman of science. Unfortunately, recent biographers of Curie often feel compelled to dwell on her brief, imprudent love affair with a fellow scientist several years after her husband Pierre died. Such attention unfairly overshadows the moderation and single-minded devotion that she exhibited throughout her life. The secret to her greatness is summed up nicely in another quote from Emling's biography. In Curie's own words, "Life is not easy for any of us, but what of that? We must have perseverance and above all confidence in ourselves. We must believe that we are gifted for something, and that this thing, at whatever cost, must be attained." Another distinguished example of self-mastery is George Washington Carver, the African-American botanist and inventor. He was born into slavery in Missouri in the early 1860s, and then raised and educated by his former master and his wife after the abolition of slavery. In his early teens, he moved alone to Kansas to take advantage of better educational opportunities for blacks. After graduating from high school in Kansas, Carver homesteaded a plot of land and studied art and piano at Simpson College in Iowa. He later attended Iowa State Agricultural College, receiving a master's degree and teaching for a time as the first black faculty member at Iowa State. In 1896, Carver was recruited by Booker T. Washington to lead the agriculture department at the Tuskegee Institute for Black Students in Alabama. He taught at Tuskegee for the next 47 years, becoming one of the most well-known and respected African Americans of his time, developing a close friendship with Henry Ford and meeting with several U.S. presidents. Carver promoted crop rotation and helped Southern farmers replenish the soil with alternatives to cotton, such as peanuts and sweet potatoes. Like Marie Curie, George Washington Carver lived an extremely simple and frugal lifestyle. He consecrated his life to sharing scientific research and providing practical advice to anyone who might benefit from his expertise. One of the secrets to his success is captured by the following advice he gave to students on getting things done. Quote, "Back of my workshop there is a little grove of trees. One has been cut down. It makes a good seat. I have made it a rule to go out and sit on it at 4 o'clock every morning and ask the good Lord what I am to do that day. Then I go ahead and do it." Close quote. Both Curie and Carver faced stifling opposition in their quest for learning. She as a woman in a male-dominated society, and he as a black man in a racially segregated one. Without perseverance, self-discipline, and the toughness to rise above obstacles, they would have fallen far short of their scientific ambitions. In short, without the self-mastery that grows from a passion for learning and for advancing the noble cause of science, neither scientist could have overcome the challenges of their lives. Both scientists could be criticized for their lack of prudence in making better use of financial opportunities. If Curie had been willing to patent more of her discoveries, she would have been less dependent on benefactors for research funds and laboratory space. But her refusal to patent her work was a principled decision, based on a commitment to scientific progress. In 1916, Carver turned down an apparently lucrative offer from Thomas Edison's chief engineer, choosing to remain at Tuskegee with an inferior laboratory and limited research funds. However, like Marie Curie, Carver's decision was a principled one. His actions were based on the desire to bless the lives of his African-American students and to promote the mission of the school at Tuskegee. Now we're ready to dive into some recent social scientific studies. Here again, our purpose is to test Aristotle's philosophical ideas against a dose of modern reality. Let's start with some insightful ways of defining or conceptualizing self-control, which is the most common term used by psychologists in their study of self-mastery. A social psychologist named Roy Baumeister has defined self-control as a moral muscle that can be depleted through the overexertion of responsible decision-making. This definition implies that while self-control can be strengthened over time, it also has its limits. You can't expect to put yourself in compromising situations time after time without eventually giving in to temptation. And you need to give yourself regular breaks from daily challenges and responsibilities, time to relax and recharge your willpower, as it were. I believe we can find support in Baumeister's research for the idea of moderate ascetic practices that strengthen your self-control, your moral muscle. This is the kind of training that's not just for addicts and others who need therapy. It's for those of us who are committed to developing self-mastery a few small steps at a time. Psychologists Walter Mischel and Özlem Aydak promote the idea that self-control is managed by a hot-cool system of self-regulation. This theory helps us to understand the role of stress and anxiety in your ability to exercise self-control. The HOT system, which is more active when you are experiencing high stress levels, is fueled by emotions for quick processing and decision-making. The COOL system involves more reflective cognitive processes and is more amenable to self-control. It tends to become more dominant as you age and is active under moderate stress levels. As with so many other keys to happiness, Mischel and Aydak's research points to the value of moderation. In this case, moderate stress and anxiety is conducive to self-control and responsible behavior. While high stress levels can induce you to act quickly based on a sort of survival instinct, high stress can also suppress your rationality and self-control. A group of Dutch psychologists, De Boer, Van Hooft, and Baker, distinguish between what they call start and stop control. In other words, the self-control required to stop undesirable behavior and the type of control needed to start desirable behavior. For example, stop control is needed to refrain from overeating, while start control is needed to initiate a physical exercise regimen. One of the main takeaways from this study is that some people have more difficulty with stop control, while others struggle with start control. Turning back to Aristotle, we might suggest that start and stop control have a lot to do with pleasure. when engaging in a pleasurable activity, it's difficult to stop. And when you're trying to find the motivation to start a desirable activity, you need to anticipate the pleasure it can bring, either immediately or as a longer-term reward for hard work. Many social scientific studies focus on the benefits of exercising self-control as a quest for human excellence and a quest for balance. A group of researchers led by Wilhelm Hoffman at the University of Chicago found that self-control leads to greater happiness and life satisfaction. This correlation goes both ways. A happier person is better able to exercise self-control, and a self-controlled person is naturally happier. Generally speaking, what they call trait self-control reduces the conflict in your life, helps you to achieve goals, and enables you to better manage conflicts when they arise. But self-control certainly goes beyond personal fulfillment. Roy Baumeister argues that you exercise self-control primarily for the benefit of others. He observes that our modern Western society tends to hamper the cultivation of self-control through destabilizing social relationships and promoting the kind of self-interest that comes with less personal accountability. Your ability to exercise self-control depends to a large extent on how you construe or interpret daily choices. A group of psychologists led by Kentaro Fujita at New York University found that you're usually better off if you step back and look at the big picture, understanding your desire for self-control on a higher, more abstract level. For example, as a student preparing for a final exam, you might properly view an invitation to attend a late-night party as an obstacle in achieving your goal of doing well on the exam. When viewing the party invitation in this context, you're more likely to exercise self-control. You construe the situation more rationally and are able to ignore less relevant aspects of the situation that might tempt you to succumb, such as your desire to relax and joke with friends at the party. This group of psychologists discovered that when you're in a more positive mood, you have a greater ability to construe a situation at a higher, more rational level. Now, the example I just mentioned, a student exercising self-control to study for an exam, underscores the importance of being goal-oriented if you hope to avoid attractive temptation. Without clear goals, you're much more likely to indulge your fleshly instincts. In working toward worthy goals, it makes sense that you should always view daily choices as one in a series of future choices leading to the reward you're seeking. But the work of experimental psychologists Uzma Khan and Ravi Dhar offer some less intuitive advice about factoring in future choices when faced with a moment of temptation. Khan and Dhar found that it's often better to view a choice as an isolated one, rather than as one in a series of future choices. Here's a good example. Suppose you're attending a 3-day business conference where all of your meals are included in your conference registration. If you're on a strict diet that rules out sugary sweets, it would be a mistake to see that piece of cheesecake on the first day as only one of a dozen or so chances to deviate from your strict diet. The idea is that it would reduce the amount of guilt you feel by indulging in temptation, since you can say to yourself just this once, out of a possible dozen, instead of viewing eating the cheesecake as an isolated decision. Sometimes self-control requires an eye focused on the future goal, but sometimes it needs a laser-like focus on the current moment. The final set of studies we'll explore for a moment emphasize the need for social support in maintaining self-control. For many years, psychologists have understood the importance of social support in helping people overcome addiction. A number of years ago, British psychologist Ray Hodgson explored the feasibility of cue exposure in strengthening self-control. This means intentionally exposing a person to cues that trigger addictive behavior. For example, study participants who struggle with alcohol addiction are exposed to parties and pubs where they are most tempted to indulge. The idea is to practice creating a storm and then riding it out. This strategy can obviously backfire when you lack the willpower to resist temptation. It turns out the key to whether or not these participants were successful in cue exposure treatment was continuous social support, including the chance to talk through frustration and feelings of discouragement. Those who lack the encouragement and support of friends and family have very little chance of overcoming addiction. Next, An interesting study from two business researchers, Michael Lowe and Kelly Hawes. They were interested in how people are influenced by the self-control decisions of their associates. For example, joining a colleague for dinner will often include a decision on whether to abstain from alcoholic beverages. Lowe and Hawes call this a parallel self-control decision. Here's what they found. If the self-gratification is not very serious, such as spending money on an amusement park or indulging in sweets, consumers tend to bond together in justifying and choosing vice. We might call this a partners-in-crime approach. However, if the indulgence is more serious, people tend to join together in abstaining and helping to keep each other accountable. Here again, we see the importance of social support in overcoming undesirable behavior like drug addiction and extravagant spending. Finally, a study led by Rand Kivitz, a psychologist at Columbia University, reached interesting conclusions about the possible negative effects of social interaction. This study explored how people justify different forms of self-gratification. Kivitz found that when you work hard and receive praise from others regarding your high level of excellence, you are much more likely to feel entitled to indulge in small vices. By contrast, this study reported that you are more likely to exercise self-control and delay gratification if an activity costs money rather than simply time and effort. That's a pretty good taste of the vast number of social scientific studies on self-control. Our discussion of Aristotle's philosophy led us to use the term self-mastery rather than temperance or self-control. But it's clear that these studies on self-control can help us in our quest to achieve true self-mastery. Here are some of the highlights. First, we considered how a passion for learning and a commitment to scientific progress led to self-mastery in the lives of Marie Curie and George Washington Carver. If you're struggling to find your own path to self-mastery, you should sense the importance of living with a clear purpose in your life, whether that purpose is the advancement of human knowledge, strengthening your family, or achieving excellence in some other worthy endeavor. Each one of us is gifted in some direction that can help clear the path to self-mastery. Second, it's helpful to understand self-control, or more specifically willpower, as a limited resource that can run out if you don't avoid temptation and take time to relax and reinvigorate yourself. You need to be particularly aware of this fact when you're in a highly emotional or anxiety-filled state. Self-renewal gives you a chance to pause and listen to reason. We also proposed that moderate, ascetic practices can help you cultivate self-control or strengthen your moral muscle. Third, it seems that Aristotle is spot on when he defines self-control in relation to pleasure. We all know that pleasurable behaviors can be difficult to stop. They're addictive for a reason. But you can start desirable behaviors by anticipating the pleasure that will come as a reward for self-control. Fourth, people who have learned to exercise self-control are happier and more capable of dealing with conflict in their lives. Fifth, when we're faced with everyday choices that call for self-control, we're normally better off understanding those choices on a more abstract level. We interpret the choice to refrain from oversleeping, for example, as an important step in achieving a successful career. Finally, in your quest for a more self-disciplined life, you need social support. You need the help of friends and family members who have your best interest at heart. You also need to be aware that social interaction can lead to a partners-in-crime approach, where you join with another person in rationalizing or taking license to indulge in pleasure. Next time, we'll discuss some final practical tips on how to achieve self-mastery in your personal life. Welcome back to The Character Cure. Self-mastery, part 3. Let's conclude with some practical tips on cultivating true self-mastery. The first tip is that you need some hope. You need to somehow discover and cultivate an optimistic mindset, which leads to more rational thinking and behavior. Most of us have one or more areas in our lives where we already have achieved a level of self-mastery. You might look to a particular friendship, a relationship with a particular family member, or an area in your personal life where you have achieved balance and composure. Perhaps a hobby or something that involves achieving a level of expertise. Give yourself credit where credit is due, and then allow this self-realization to give you hope in developing self-control in other areas. As with the other virtues, we've promoted self-mastery as a high ideal. But in the reality of your personal life, the best approach is simply to make progress, however small. Don't become discouraged by the areas of your life that are characterized by overindulgence and a lack of self-control. We all have things to work on, one step at a time. Second tip, ask for the support of friends and family members who care deeply about your happiness. When you're ready to deal with your demons, you can't go it alone. You need support. This is also where practical wisdom comes into play. Understanding your personal weaknesses means you're capable of avoiding people and places that make it more difficult to exercise self-control. If you've struggled with substance abuse in the past, both practical wisdom and common sense say you can't keep hanging out with so-called friends who are really partners in vice. Philosophers and social scientists both like to talk about the social nature of the virtues. This is just as true with the virtues that have the word self attached to them. Self-confidence, self-control, and self-mastery are as much about relationships as they are about private thoughts and introspection. Third tip. Speaking of family and personal relationships, remember that self-mastery means controlling yourself, not manipulating and controlling other people. One of the surest ways to damage a relationship is to violate someone's autonomy. In other words, don't be a control freak. Be generous with the flaws and shortcomings of others. When it comes to self-mastery, follow the advice of Confucius to demand much from yourself and little from others. Fourth tip. Consistent with Roy Baumeister's concept of self-control as a moral muscle, each one of us can benefit from a regular exercise regimen, which I'm describing as moderate asceticism. All successful, well-adjusted people understand the need for self-denial. These people have cultivated a robust form of self-discipline built on the foundation of physical and mental habits. If you're personally struggling with the tendency to overindulge or with a self-defeating lack of control in some area of your life, consider the value of a training program to build your moral muscle and transform your desires. Here are 10 practical examples of moderate asceticism that I encourage you to try on a regular basis. I briefly mentioned a few of these earlier. Number 1. Every month or so, consider fasting for 24 hours, skipping a couple of meals and spending time focusing on the needs of your soul more than the needs of your body. Donate the food or the money you would have spent on food to a local food bank for needy families. Number 2. Wake up early in the morning every day for 2 weeks. Whether it's 4, 5, or 6 a.m., wake up at the same time every morning, regardless of when you go to sleep. Spend some time meditating, reflecting on your life's purpose, and planning for the day. If you're a man or a woman of religious faith, spend a few minutes each morning in earnest prayer. Number 3. Strictly limit your technology and media consumption for an entire week. You might consider limiting your use of the internet and email to your time at work. Use your time at home to engage in old-fashioned activities such as playing board games with the family, reading, and having face-to-face conversations. Number 4. Lock up your credit cards for an entire month and limit your purchases that month to your essential needs. At the end of the month, give all of your surplus budget away to charity. Number 5. Take a cold shower every morning for a week. Number 6. Regularly go through your closet and remove 10 to 20 items of clothing that you haven't worn in a long time. Give them away to a local thrift store. Keep doing this every few weeks until you begin to feel that your life has been simplified. Try the same exercise with other material possessions in your life. Number 7. If you haven't developed the habit of exercising regularly, set aside 1 week to begin such a habit. Choose a time to engage in vigorous exercise every day for that entire week. Number 8, devote an hour each day to learning a foreign language. Fill the entire hour with rigorous, focused study and practice. Number 9, cancel your leisure activities for 2 weekends in a row. Spend those weekends instead volunteering at a soup kitchen or other community service program. Number 10, commit yourself to a strict 1-week diet, limiting your calories by 1/3, eliminating sweets, and avoiding all fast food restaurants. Any one of these practices will improve your moral conditioning and make you more capable of achieving excellence in the things that really matter in your life. Fifth and final tip. In your quest to develop self-mastery, consciously cultivate and enjoy the simple pleasures of life. In the process of devoting your time and attention to these abundant moments, areas of moral weakness will tend to fall out of your life. To the degree that you simplify your life and embrace the simple pleasures of family, friends, nature, or a good book, you'll find greater hope that leads to greater self-control. For me personally, one of the keys to a happy and successful midlife career transition has been learning to find pleasure and purpose in writing, in producing something of value each day, however small it might be. This is the key to transforming character, learning to find pleasure in things of greater value. The distinct pleasure I personally find when discovering and then crafting a new idea in writing has given me a small taste of the sweet fruit of self-mastery. Now let's summarize the 5 tips. First, give yourself credit for the areas in your life where you have achieved a level of self-mastery. Second, ask family members and friends for their support. Third, control yourself, not other people. Fourth, improve your moral conditioning by adopting moderate ascetic practices. And fifth, cherish the simple pleasures of your life, including time with family and friends, reading a good book, or starting a new hobby. I'll end with a couple of personal challenges to move forward on the path to self-mastery. The first challenge is to choose one of the 10 moderate ascetic practices I just introduced and work it into your schedule this week. Second, I invite you to begin a simple, wholesome hobby that gives you pleasure, something you can learn to do well, something that adds a little beauty to your life or makes a small difference in your community. Self-mastery does require willpower, but it's probably even more about a refined capacity to enjoy the wholesome pleasures of life. In conclusion, the journey toward self-mastery is worth the effort. It means you're learning to appreciate the gift of life and to live that life with passion. We're talking about pleasures that don't come at the expense of other people. In fact, self-control and self-mastery give you greater time and energy for loved ones and others in need. Achieving self-mastery means that you've attained a level of happiness and vitality that spills over into deep relationships, satisfying careers, and compassionate living. Thanks for joining me. For more resources on character education, check out my website at charactercure.com.